Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Oh, hi, everybody. Hello.
Justin Robert Young.
Oh, hello, friends.
And Brian Brushwood.
Oh, my God. A whole week of not doing South by Southwest. It was great.
A week's an interesting length of time. What would be, if you had to do an endurance stunt for a week that would maybe you knew would get some attention, what would you do for a week?
Oh, wow. So we are talking about in the David Blaine style of something that would attract attention. Are we thinking about something that will attract attention and cut through the clutter?
Yeah.
So the first thing that pops into mind is flagpole sitting, which all of a sudden I realized I have no idea what the world record for flagpole sitting is. Before we check, Justin, do you have a guess what the world record is?
Nor do I know what level of Harvey Danger we'd need to do it.
I guess that was a fad during the Roaring Twenties. Was that and packing bodies into a phone booth, and but sitting up on a flagpole was a popular stunt.
Well, that was contemporary to like dance marathons, right?
Yeah, I guess. See how long you could Charleston.
All I know about that is that it was a popular form of entertainment in the Great Depression because it just took forever. Like there was just. Everybody was really excited about something that passed time because everybody was poor.
I mean, I could have sworn it was during the Roaring Twenties, which would have been before the Great Depression.
The opposite. Okay, well then maybe dance marathons came afterward then.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. BioCow brings up stuffing a VW bug. That's one that we saw more recently.
Flagpole sitting in the 1920s was a major part of the decade, died out after 1929.
Okay, so here, do we have a guess on what the longest flagpole sitter was?
Please reset what a flagpole sitter is.
Because, it's quite literally a flagpole, and usually there would be, as I understood it, like an 8-inch by 8-inch thing at the top, and you would just sit there, and it was an endurance stunt. Kind of like David Blaine's thing, only you actually had to engage your core, unlike David Blaine's thing, where you just laid around and looked like a hobo for 30 days.
Well, that was in the box, right?
Yeah.
Because he did stand on something once.
Probably. I'm told he is capable of standing.
Yeah, I've also heard such rumors. I have no idea. Literally, when you said flagpole sitting, I thought you were making a joke about the Harvey Danger song.
Well, no. Which that song is a reference to, to the practice of flagpole sitting.
Sure, yeah. And to be honest, at the point that song was out, I had no clue what it was a reference to anything.
Nobody
other than
did. It was provocative. Percent. Nobody knew.
All right, do we have any information
I'm gonna guess,
how long a flagpole sitter?
I'm going to guess 42 hours.
Here's the problem with flagpole sitting, and I have answers to this, is that there's – I'm going to sit on the edge of the pole, then there's people who've sat on platforms.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And a platform thing isn't the same as having to keep your core strength up because a platform can just be, I'm just going to curl up and take a nap here and just not roll off.
Still fairly impressive to this guy, but whether it's a let's say assuming it's either a platform or a pole.
All right, Brian, I know what you're getting at. Everybody, dial up all your media contacts. Come on, come all. Brian Brushwood will be debuting his brand new compound on the Austin city limits by breaking the world record for flagpole sitting.
Well, specifically playing Hearthstone while sitting on a flagpole. I figure that's a very small.
Don't give away the whole show.
Okay, right.
Give away the whole show. We're getting them. We're building the tip here. Everybody's going to get on in and everyone's going to watch the magnificent, amazing Brian Brushwood flagpole sitting, once thought to be a lost art, on his travels throughout Indochina. Brian Brushwood revived the flagpole sitting experience. So what we don't know is how long he will last. Brian has has threatened to go as long as 48 hours.
should I mention that the pole's only 4 feet tall? Okay.
They're making these phones bigger and bigger, huh?
There are no rules to flag. I'm just saying there is no we may have to start the official flagpole sitting committee.
Okay.
Because
I hereby call this meeting to order of the flagpole sitting authority.
Yeah, it doesn't look like this is something Guinness keeps track of. But yeah. there I found a few things on Wikipedia that might be considered records. So Brian, you said 48 hours?
I said 42.
42 hours. Okay.
Justin, do you have a guess?
Yeah, I mean I would push it around there. I would say 48, yeah.
Andrew, do you know?
Yeah, I know. I had to look into this before, and thus the whole it's complicated. It's absurdly long because once you change it from I'm on a pole to I'm got kind of a little platform here, and Brian dismissed, but there is a very big difference between trying to balance yourself and having basically a treehouse on a pole and how long you can endure up there.
So one of the early records in 1924 was 13 hours. Not long after, that record became 12, 17, and then 21 days.
What?
Let's see. In 1930, another record was set for 51 days, 20 hours.
Man, that's not real. Like you've got working plumbing. Richard, you have a shower up there.
See, Brian, when I pointed this out, you're like, "Oh, but I still hold this."
You said a
valiant flagpole sitters.
You said
not all sitters.
A platform. It depends on the size. If you're talking about the platform the size of a double wide trailer, then that's significantly different than the 8-inch by 8-inch platform I described at the beginning of this.
The record's like 200 days.
Yeah, so in...
Oh, my God, really?
In 1964, a record of 217 days was set by Peggy Townsend Clark. And then I don't know if you've seen this one here from the 80s, Andrew.
Kenneth Gidge?
David Werder. David Werder.
Oh, man, household names, legends.
In a protest against the price of gasoline, he sat atop a pole for 439 days, 11 hours, and 6 minutes.
Now,
in your face, Carter!
Isn't there also, like in the 1970s, an iteration of billboard sitting? Like people who would get up and protest by just hanging out on billboards? Which sounds closer to the creature comforts that Andrew was describing.
I definitely have seen people protesting billboards and stuff like that.
I just like the idea the guy's up on top of the pole or platform or whatever, you know, has to, you know, use a bucket and living in a stupid pole. And he's like, man, those Exxon guys, I'm going to get them. And imagine the boardroom where they're like, oh, you know, we got to raise price 3 cents. Like, yeah, the guy's on, he's been on the pole for four months, guys.
Oh, dude, imagine how he's like sitting up there. He's like, oh, those Exxon guys, I'll bet you they're just so mad right now. I'm embarrassing them so much. Oh, I bet you they got steams coming out of their ears. That's how smash cut to all of the Exxon executives cheating on their wives and smoking cigars. Like,
we need to crash another boat, guys. Oil prices are too low. Where's that drunk captain?
All right, so Brian, are you in? Are we doing the a flagpole sitting demonstration to open the compound?
I mean,
500 days of flagpoles. Let's do it.
You know what?
Start going now. The time that all the renovations were done, you have to shoot all the episodes up there.
I mean, if you want to spoil the ending, we're using pole-based technology to build everything on the new compound. So there's going to be like a giant game of Floor is Hot Lava. I'm just going to hop from pole to pole. Yeah. I'll not touch ground for a year.
I have an idea, a radical idea. I'm trying to find...
I'm glad.
Bear with me.
Brush away these mundane Brian stands on a flagpole for 500 days ideas, so we can get to the real spice.
I'm gonna find this. I have a solution, Brian.
Okay.
All right.
Moon shoes.
What
not
we
technically
do
touching the ground.
I mean, actually, hold on. If I just affix a number of poles to my shoes, aka stilts.
Stilts. Yeah.
I was looking to find the opposite of Austin, Texas, because we could just stick a pole in the ground there, an upside down pole. And basically use the pole plus the entire earth, and there you are.
An earth cake pop. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, because like if we have,
like
we
technically
see the platform,
all
any
of
size,
Austin
how
is
about the size of the earth.
I mean, technically all of Austin is just a big platform on the other side of the earth's pole to this section of the Pacific or Atlantic or Indian Ocean. I don't know geography.
First in Austin.
Yeah, it ends nowhere. I mean, like this is where like you lose Malaysian jetliners and Lost.
Yeah. You know what? Not that you can verify it, but I do remember I did put a poll there. Definitely put a poll there. And in fact, I've already begun. I've been doing it for 795 days.
What?
Brian, why did you tell
us that? That explains why you've been playing Hearthstone.
Brian, why didn't you just tell us this before? We're your friends.
Yeah, well, you know, I forgot. I was very busy.
We're going to have a conversation, Brian, about this.
So this seems like something that definitely got swept away because people just killed the record by making them really, really, really boring records that aren't.
Well, and like, the only way to make them safe was to, oh my gosh.
So this is the 200 plus day. I see you sent this. This is a link to Peggy's poll, and this is a treehouse.
Yeah, that's a treehouse with privacy.
It's got a radio ad on it.
she's pooping in a bucket in the back there. That's
There's a roof.
It does have a roof. That it seems like that should be. I mean, look, I know we were joking around, we were horsing off before about creating the flagpole sitter's authority, but I feel like we should, and we should be separating these things into divisions. We should have our own games done quick, polls done sat on weekend where we stream everything. We stream different kinds of records. What would you say? What would you guys want the different divisions to be? Certainly the treehouse division obviously is there. What are the restrictions that Brian, you would like to see for other flag?
I mean, for the pro league, I'd like to see the umbrella top academy where it's like you sit on a folded closed umbrella and just, you know, you take turns sitting one cheek on it and then you switch to the
other cheek.
Oh,
so you're balancing the umbrella up too.
No. I mean, the umbrella is mounted. I'm saying you've got that like it's tight.
Okay.
We should like the record should be you divide the area you're sitting on or number of days by the amount of area you're sitting on.
Okay. Oh, so you could have it be as big as you want, but it's going to be a long record. Yeah.
The sitter's constant.
And so if you are, if let's say it's just a pole with like a flat, like it's literally just the circumference of the pole that it's flat and you are like pigeon toeing on top of, then that's like the minimum that you could possibly have. All that time counts as clean. Mm-hmm. But if you have even a little bit of a surface area that you can put both your feet down, now you're taking time off the clock.
Well, and I'll tell you what, now all of a sudden I'm realizing you put up a single wide trailer up on a pole and then you give birth to a child who never knows anything but living in that and you can go for a very long time. That's a world champion right there.
There we go. I'll tell you what, you might
the
have
pole
loophole.
Now, all right, what about a division where people throw things at you?
Projectiles. Heckler division.
Yeah.
Where it's like you also have to do stand-up comedy or a 3-hour radio show every single day. And then
whatever you want. Like, I mean, you get obviously this is where you have your real showmen are there so they can really perform. But the idea is that all comers can throw things at you.
It's got to be limited to fruit or tomatoes only
hand
league.
Hand thrown. No t-shirt cannons. Sure. I mean, certainly no firearms. That's right out. Like, but
I'm gonna throw some bullets at you.
You're still in the realm of like, you know, somebody tossing a grapefruit and you're taking a Louisville Slugger and just knocking it up there at them. Pretty rough.
But a bat, or is that mechanical?
That's
help?
The home run derby league.
I mean, that's a derby league. Offset that by getting a bunch of air mattresses and setting them around the bottom. So now it's safe if you do fall.
So you probably wouldn't want to do air mattresses for safety.
Well, okay, you have air mattresses, and then to handle the bounce, you have regular mattresses.
Yeah,
so outside
both mattresses. The committee decrees.
Yeah.
So the point I want to get to is actually is we have another record to talk about, which is, ladies and gentlemen, Jack Wilmot.
Legend.
The founder of Studio Disrupt VR. He spent 168 consecutive hours. He spent a week in a VR headset.
Okay, which one?
Is it
a Vive? Are we talking Pimax? Because that's a feat if you're holding that giant thing.
He used an Oculus, and then he switched to like an untethered when he had to eat or whatever. But he basically was an Oculus, and so he closed his eyes when he switched headsets. He live streamed the whole thing on Twitch. And said that it was, you know, kind of an experiment, but it's great if you're into, if you're a VR promoter and you want to do something cool. Great
is,
gimmick. Great
is bit. It? Is it? Is it? Is that a great gimmick? Is that how we want people to perceive VR?
I'm reading about him and his VR company right now. I would say yeah.
We are giving him press. That's what he wanted, right?
But are we breathlessly discussing him with deep admiration?
Is that your point of failure? Is if you don't reach your emotional point there? I mean, specifically,
it seems to me like if you wanted to generate a lot of press about your VR thing, it would be about how easy it is, not what a monumental achievement it is to wear this medieval torture looking device on your face for a week.
So right now what we're looking at is him watching something render.
Yeah, like he's looking at a Premiere window rendering. So he's not even playing a game the whole time.
He was doing some work with just that emulation there right there in front of his face in VR.
Looks like it.
Yeah.
Let's see.
We have some games. He plays the virtual bus. The bus.
Is that Desert Bus? He played VR Desert Bus?
Yeah, he played VR Desert Bus, it looks like, for 4, 5, 6 days. So most of this is Desert Bus.
Back to your point, Andrew. I don't know that this is exactly the type of press I want for VR if I want to promote VR.
Yeah, I mean, for his goal is not to promote VR. His goal is to say, hey, I'm going to do an interesting experiment with VR. What do I find out? And he got coverage everywhere. And if you're going from zero to all of a sudden a week later, you're the guy. Conferences, all of this sort of stuff. This guy spent a week in VR. He's now put himself into the conversation in a very public way. And so I'm saying, like, it's brilliant. It's brilliant because
I agree. Anybody who's booking a VR speaker, he is going to have, because other than I own a VR company or I develop for VR, everybody's just like, I like it. I'm a fan. I really like doing it. Like, there's no VR celebrities. There's no super big VR Twitch streamers that consistently get big numbers. So all of a sudden, he has totally cut himself out beyond the pack as I am more familiar with VR than anybody else you're going to read in a, you know, the brochure of speakers that are speaking today.
Well, so what were the big enlightening takeaways that we got from this?
He said that when he took off the goggles, he was relieved. He says, man, the graphics in reality are much better. he was interesting him talking about what he got used to. He said sleeping was easier than he thought. You know, he said it was easier to sleep than he expected it to be. You know, there was a brightness issue, whatever. But, you know, I think, you know, like, You know, he's a filmmaker. He's not a guy. Oh, pardon me. He's not a guy developing hardware. He's a guy who wants to get into content and whatnot. And I think as far as I think it's brilliant. Because congratulations, this guy's now gets to be the guy who did the thing.
And yeah, he is certainly the guy who did the thing, without a doubt. That is a cheers, kings to him. That he is the guy that spent a week in virtual reality.
But, and I have a feeling that, like, I don't know, 20 years from now, it'd be like, what, only a week? It'll be like, well, what? I haven't taken off mine in 3 years.
I mean, to be honest, the biggest thing that I would say for him is, man, I want to know what pad that he has that seals around his eyes. Because that's, you know, if I do it for more than an hour or so, like I'm already getting irritation around my my the mask line.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's I guess it just strikes me as a bit odd for something that their goal should be to make it as easy to go 3 years at a time as possible to sing the praises of somebody who made it a week. Because I'm with you. It's like I've worn these glasses for 2 whole years. I've never looked at anything without them. It's like, well, that should be closer to where we're at on VR.
I'm just, again, he's a filmmaker. He's a VR filmmaker, whatever, and so he's an artist. And so he's approaching it from an artist's point of view and not somebody who says, I make great tech or I make this. He's like, let me do an experiment with myself.
What's his name?
Jack Wilmot.
Glad
I did say it earlier, but that's okay.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to say right now, and that is patreon.com/weirdthings is where you can support this show. If you head on over there right now to patreon.com/weirdthings, you can kick us in a little, a buck or two. Throw a dollar right at our face. Here's the deal. When you are a patron, you get your custom RSS feed that gets you early access to After Things. That is the show we do after Weird Things, wherein we discuss a lot of business stuff. If you're a creator, a maker, an entrepreneur, you want to ask a question, this is the time that you can do it. And you get that access right there on your phone. It's so easy with these custom RSS feeds. I swear. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
All right. Another tech thing relating to this is that, let's say you're in VR and you want to talk to your friends in VR. Having some sort of avatar or having something that, does that for you is ideal. But if you've got your face in this headset, it's not like you can put a camera in front of you here. Or there are times where we want to talk to people and maybe we just want to speak, but we don't want to go on camera. I mean, I wear my hat because, my hair is usually, all over the place. I don't want to frighten anybody. If I could have a virtual Andrew, probably be better. Have you seen the new Facebook tech they're working on for creating your own avatar in real time?
No. The closest I had heard of was there are Vive improvements that involve eye tracking so that for the user, it shifts the focus to whatever they're looking at. But I would imagine that would have applications for virtual avatars so that you're able to get things like those subtle facial cues that mean so much to us in nonverbal communication.
Yeah. So they've got a demo up of their new realistic face tracking avatars, and they're really good. They're not there yet, but we're better off than early 2000s, computer generated movies, Polar Express. I think it's better than Polar Express, I'll put it that way.
So wow. That is pretty good.
Having a conversation. Wanted to give us the play by play?
Yeah, so we're seeing two people have a conversation, and each of them are looking like the genie from Pee-wee's Playhouse, just sort of floating heads.
Mika-licka hi, Mika-hiney ho.
But they're rendered really well. I mean, they do have ever so slightly kind of like what you notice is that the smiles don't seem to exactly track because those obviously aren't being seen by the gear. But I assume they're being implied by watching, eyelines tighten. And they're sort of estimated, but that looks like a very credible. You could have a significant, valuable conversation with someone like this.
This is a stunning and vicious rebuke of Rogue One.
Yeah, these the eyes are a little bit. You look at the eyes and the mouth, and you can kind of tell. But these are things that get better. As we've seen with just algorithms and like deep fakes and stuff like this, is that it's somebody doing a 2-weekend project to figure out. And that was a big problem for years in eyes was CGI eyes was that people treated them just like kind of reflective glass balls or whatever without really understanding how eyes work, and that's why eyes looked weird. And then now eyes look way, way better in CG. And here, trying to do this and map the face. And, you look at, we showed before, like on iOS, the 3D face renderer, and how you can just, the camera on the front of your iPhone is capable of getting a 3D image of your face that you can look at it from different angles. And that tech's only going to get better. This is really disturbing. We're looking at people doing, going through the mouth ranges, rah, rah, rah.
It does look like the showing your work on the fact that there were just going to be like either digital or physical replicates built of us, right? Like this would be shown in with like creepy horror music if we were to discover this in some hidden cache after we understand that the robots have won.
Right now, if I had a good enough avatar, would it be okay if I told you guys, like, yeah, I'll do the show, but I'm just going to use my avatar instead of my stupid face?
I mean, to be totally honest, I think there are a lot of opportunities to do that. And we've kind of seen as Skype has continued to get bigger, even in broadcast television, more of that become the standard. But I don't think that we're at the final form of I don't have good video, or I would rather have passable, interesting video combined with very good audio. Yeah, no, I think we could... At a certain level of photorealism, I think a Andrew Avatar would be great.
I mean, keep in mind, given our recent history as far as bandwidth goes, I think that some of us might be giddy at the thought of an always present Andrew Avatar. But
yeah, cherub's like, yeah, it'll have, you know, better internet connection than I do.
and of course, we're not the best example because a lot of people listen just by audio only, but like, think about even a broadcast television thing in a world where all your sports channels are increasingly just throwing, you know, radio programs on the air, and it's not really important how everything looks. I can totally imagine a talk celebrity who happens to show up on video, maybe, I don't know, like having an accident or whatever, and, you know, maybe even a disfiguring accident, and he just announces, or he or she just announces, yeah, you know what, for a while I'm just going to have this avatar be my thing. And at some point they forget that it's an avatar. It becomes like a prosthetic, basically, because it's like, you guys would all rather think of me the way I think of me, and here I am as the way all of us think of me.
I'll tell you, that actually is fascinating. We certainly saw in the advent of HD, there was this worry that, like, oh my God, now all of a sudden, as 4K and HD become the norm, everyone's going to look older. People are going to be able to age gracefully less and less. We saw some people, you know, most notably kind of Barbara Walters, who had always used some element of, you know, big
soft
gaunty,
lenses,
soft, yeah, kind of filters. Now that was even more of a thing. But
The example that I'm thinking of specifically is, remember when Roger Ebert had his lower jaw removed? Like at that point, imagine, you know, it was a big deal when they were able to recreate his voice synthetically. But now we're at the point where they could not only recreate his voice synthetically, but also recreate his face. And he's like, hey, it's still me. Like, imagine he's still writing all his reviews. And it's like, we're just, you know, using prosthetics so it's as comfortable for you as possible to still watch me do my thing.
That is fascinating. That would be a fascinating thing to look at him to do. I mean, geez, think of it like this even. Let's just go. I mean, obviously, Ebert has since passed on. But let's take all the reviews that he wrote, which he did for years and years after he left television, and just say, now we're going to take the movies that are the best, right? That's still, you know, we would want the Ebert take on it. And you just create the lost Ebert monologues. You do a YouTube channel or something that is just a computer generated version using that algorithm that voice that he used toward the end of his life. And now we get heretofore unseen yet written by the man, although not delivered by the man, Ebert monologues.
And what's weird is that it would be so good that I feel like the debate would instantly shift from whether or not this is a fair representation of Robert Ebert, because they were his words, his reviews, he put them out there. And I think we would instantly start arguing about which of them aged better and which of them, you know, because he didn't like Fight Club when it first came out. And I think I would like to believe that if he was still around, he would see more of the value of that movie at that time. I think we'd be busy arguing about what he got wrong in his reviews and less focused on the digital prosthesis that made them possible.
And it brings up another interesting idea that too, is it's when you have very, very large data sets, like all of Roger Ebert's reviews, and you have movies, you could in theory put them, you know, have an AI look at the reviews and look at the movies. And it would be more consistent than most reviewers would be, any us included, but that's another interesting thing. It's like, you could probably at a certain point you know, I mean, you have to pre-train it on something else, but you could build a thing that could say, "I watched the movie for you. This is what you think,"
or at least pass a Turing test, right? At least pass the point where, like, yeah, I believe that's the kind of thing Roger Ebert would have said about this movie.
Yeah, I was looking through footage of a fan used an AI algorithm to up-res Deep Space Nine into HD.
How does it look?
Brian's going to show them if you find this. And that's another thing that's being done now, is that if you have pre-trained networks to understand how things look, you can actually increase up-res stuff. And, you know, it's up-resing technology is getting really, really, really good.
Yeah, well, especially because even though, let's say, you only have 320 by 240 pixels to work with, you've got to remember you have, you know, 29.97 of them per second to work with. And you can, from a single pixel, interpret, let's say, especially if it's a static locked off shot, that variation in color range as you deal with heat, shimmer, and wind and debris and whatever it is, gives you a range. And that's all data. And, you know, we look at these NASA photos. If you're seeing something pretty from NASA, it almost 100% is not the way the camera saw it or the the human eye would see it were you there. It's always, you know, pieced together from a whole bunch of different data sets. Wow, this does look pretty good.
It's a little hard to tell with the way that we have this set up. This monitor is a little smaller resolution, and then it's not the full YouTube size. He has some other images on his blog that are still images of... So you've got the original, you've got an original frame here and an up-resed 1080 frame here.
Wow.
That's pretty good detail being caught. I think we've got another, this is from the title sequence, and then the original or the full size.
Man, I mean, it makes sense. Why wouldn't, you know, an algorithm be able to figure out, you know, give or take what it looked like or what it would have looked like?
Show you something else pretty cool. If you look at, there's a site, remove.bg, and it's an AI background remover. And we see that even with Skype, they can do the blur or whatever, but it's not quite good. But I just grabbed a photo of Justin and just from the live stream. But anyhow, this stuff is really, really good now at like removing backgrounds. Like you can do this. Imagine you shoot a film. You don't even worry about the green screen. You use a really high resolution camera and you shoot your film. And then you're like, let's just change the background, because the AI is getting really good at figuring out, you know, what is. Yeah, I used one for the live stream. Oh. Yeah, but it's amazing. That just grabbed it right there. But I just took one of Justin and sitting in the environment he's in right now.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy. Yeah, I screwed around with that a little bit or something similar a while ago, because I was looking for something to do that kind of just removal without having to do the fairly tedious Photoshop, you know, cutting out stuff. But oh my God, that's even more intense than what I remember. The tools that I remember, you had to actually like draw like the background and like draw the foreground, like just somewhat, but this just popped it right out and with fairly insane precision.
Well, yeah, like to the tune of individual clumps of hair perfectly extracted.
That's where you can see a lot of some of the smoothing, especially kind of on the hairline here. But even then, it knows that it's better to kind of cut into that and smooth it out afterwards than... So the details on the beard come out pretty good because there's good separation.
I sent you one taken from the background he's in front of right now, just to give you an example when it's not this really, you know, nice depth of field.
That's not bad. You got a little bit of artifacting here. You can see a little bit more of the
bit of the background
on the white shirt.
But that's a screen grab from a Skype video. You know, I mean, that's pretty damn good. You know, it has to figure out the microphone and stuff, but
So I guess the futurist question is like, how comfortable are we going to be with increasingly digitally manufactured representations of people? I mean, we're already to a place where you go to a concert and, you know, maybe an aging celebrity can't hit those high notes. And so there's software that detects the moment you're starting to squeak out at this high C, and then just, you know, it just crossfades it into the backing vocal corrected track. Like, I think we're all okay with that. Why not a step farther? Why not entire presences?
You know, we had a couple phenomena that happened, I think, in both in the 1990s, which were sort of interesting. And that was that as we became more aware of, let's say, music click track or whatever the technology was at the time for music. And then in Magic, we watched David Blaine come out, where David Blaine, you know, you're thinking like, how can you do magic on TV in this age? And that was a problem for David Copperfield doing Big Illusions, is everybody knew about CGI and stuff. Not that that's how he did it, but you just sort of assumed anything you saw on TV could be done. And that's when you had to use reality TV elements for David Blaine. Is it shot like a documentary? It was reality. It wasn't this slickly produced thing. You felt that it was just, oh, a camera on the street. For music, you had MTV Unplugged, which was, you know, hey, we know there's all this tech and all that. We're just going to show up with our guitars and our instruments, and we're going to play in front of you and show you that we're real musicians. And there was a lot of value there.
Yeah. So I suppose we moved the bar. I wonder if some ways this is something that Twitch is extremely well positioned to take advantage of. Maybe there's a craving to go back to the electricity of a live performance and doing stuff live to tape or live, period.
Well, but I think that there's a line. Right. Like nobody ever went at the height of Britney Spears' fame. Nobody ever went to a Britney Spears concert because she was the greatest vocalist of a generation. Right. Like she was a pop star. You wanted to be there for a spectacle, and she was an icon. So if Britney Spears gets auto-tuned until the day she dies, as long as that means that people can go see her and experience something that either has them relive their childhood or something like that, then I think that they're going to be fine. Similarly, we've now seen the entire career trajectory of somebody who understood that a vocal enhancement could be something that separated him from the pack in T-Pain. That we're on the other end of, like, T-Pain is a tremendously talented singer. He became famous for doing these pop songs where he was auto-tuned beyond recognition to his speaking voice. And now he was the entire hook of the Fox Masked Singer show, where it was like, oh my God, T-Pain can really sing. Isn't this a crazy concept? So we're kind of already there in terms of using these tools, but I think the lesson is we're not going to make any rules about the tools. Like if it works for a certain person, that's fine. I think we would have rather Frank Sinatra live out his final years being able to take advantage of some of these vocal sweetening things as opposed to, you know, how he was in his latter years, where he's just kind of joking through half the songs because he can't hit the iconic notes.
And yeah, I think we're going to see these tools get so good that like anybody will be able to create music with it, but you're still going to have good ideas, good presentation.
Yeah.
But I also think, like, on the other side of it, that being able to perform live with just a guitar or piano or whatever is still going to be, you know, that'll be another draw. Like, that's how and this day you think about, like, there are certain singers and people we gravitate towards is, like, you go Adele, like, she's amazing, you know.
Yeah.
She's just, you know, they're, you know, thinking of it, you know, a number of others. You just go like, oh yeah, you hear them live or whatever, and they're just phenomenal. And so we still put value on that.
Certainly so. And that will always be, that will be in the more impressive, they would be like the flagpole sitters of singing, without
the flagpole singers.
Somebody wanted to know, do we all remember Looker? Looker was a Michael Crichton movie about they start killing off models. And
is this the one where like the girl's getting scanned and there are pluses all over her naked body, and she goes, help, rape. And then they say, and they're like, please stop moving. And it's like, it's just a joke. I think that's the first time I ever heard the word rape when I was a kid.
Michael Crichton is brilliant, but you watch the trailer. This movie does not, it's the concept, great. The idea was that like some technology company is going around scanning the most beautiful models in the world and is creating virtual models. This is like from 1979, 1980, or just something really.
81, it said, yeah.
Yeah. So, but this woman shows up and asks for help. She's supposed to get plastic surgery. She's like, I need you to make me less pretty because they're going to kill me because I'm too beautiful. And, you know, so they start killing off all these models they've scanned.
Oh, yeah. So once they have the backup copy, dude, this is the movie I was thinking of. Yeah.
Yep.
Ages before parental restrictions on cable.
So, great mention in the chat room. Great mention for that.
Look.
All right. Any picks?
All right. This was a pick that Bryce said a couple weeks ago. But Ashley and I have really gotten into it. It's kind of become our like comfort show to watch right before we go to sleep. Schitt's Creek.
Pop
original, and then I guess I'm assuming it aired somewhere in Canada primarily, right? But so this is, I don't know how many seasons. I'm only on the second season here, but it seems to be a labor of love between Eugene Levy and his son that write most of the episodes. But it is definitely like Bryce said, if although there is a similar theme of like Arrested Development, where Arrested Development is a rich family that falls on hard times and you kind of spend all your time laughing at how ridiculous they are. Certainly there is a hint of that here, but it is more, it's got a little bit more a heart to it while being, you know, giving just such a great platform for the four actors that play the family. Like they are just, it is just kind of a masterclass, including Catherine O'Hara. I mean, who's just a treasure. I mean, like the fact that we get, another just sort of like tour de force performance by her. She is one of the funniest people, funniest female, you know, comedians of all time. And I'm so glad that she gets a showcase where she just chews up the screen with this hilarious character. It's great.
Yeah.
Cool.
Dude, guys, this is the strongest recommendation I've given for anything in a long time. I went and saw Apollo 11, and it was stunning beyond words. It is a documentary from CNN Documentaries. It is a documentary with no narration, no interviews, no descriptions, no explanations, and it is all actual footage, digitally remastered, and there's, you know, Foley work to make it more palatable, but you are there as they roll the Saturn V to its launch platform. You are there in the crowd with people as they're buying corn dogs on a stick and kids are sleeping and snoozing and fussing. You are there as Apollo 11 goes to the moon and comes back, and it is amazing. The technical challenge of telling the entire story with nothing but a soundtrack and recreated audio of everything makes this so electric. And especially Justin and I, we both really enjoyed First Man. I guess all of us did. You liked it too, Bryce.
Yeah, First Man was pretty good.
And but as a companion piece, like once you've gone through the storytelling version of it, the fictionalized version of Neil Armstrong's story, which was already great because it really made you feel like you were there, to see the actual footage and be there, like that moment. the moments that the documentary helps you out are very subtle and very small, and they're usually with very small text that says things like amount of fuel left, and it expresses it in minutes. And you're watching Neil Armstrong land, and you hear the alarms going off that kept going off for no damned reason as they're landing, and you feel the tension. It's extraordinary. I cried like three or four times during it. Pretty much any time they would sweep over crowd shots of people, and you would realize how many people worked to make this astonishing engineering miracle happen. It was just great beyond words. I loved it.
Very cool. And that's in theory. I did not know that this was like out. Or like I thought that, because when you were texting me over the weekend, I thought this was that Hulu show that they canceled. But this theatrical release in theaters now.
Worth seeing in a theater.
I'm assuming that's qualifying for like award contention, right? Is that you give a movie like this a run in theaters?
I'll tell you this much: worth seeing in the theater. Like I don't know that the grandeur and that the quality of the footage would really come through on any of the small screens that I own. It's great. And Strike It Rich points out it's that film quality. It's like this was shot in basically the same technology as, you know, 2001 A Space Odyssey. And as a result, it holds up.
Yeah, I will say that was the most exciting part about First Man was understanding that you would feel that the technology, what was the greatest technical achievement that man had exhibited, was about as sophisticated as, you know, grabbing a tray from the cafeteria and sliding down a snowy hill. Like, it was just so ramshackle compared to how we are ensconced in technology these days. And the men that were running, fighting, jockeying with each other to have the honor of being the guys that achieved this goal, even after their compatriots had, like, died in front of them, is remarkable and insane.
I sent Bryce a photo. I took this about 2 weeks ago inside the vehicle assembly building, which is where they put the rocket together. And you look at the external photos of the assembly building and how big it is. Then you get in there and you realize it's big, and you realize there's a whole separate section on one side where the shuttle gets built. And you're looking like, this is something built in the 60s, and the scale of this building that was like the largest building by volume or whatever in the world. It's insane. And so I took a panoramic shot, started at my feet going all the way up and back over. It's just insane. You look at the scale of this thing, and it's, you see these rockets are hard to judge the size of, you know. Remember we walked into SpaceX and we saw that big thing coming out from the wall that looked like a truss or whatever. And it's like, it's a landing leg, guys. And we're like, oh,
yeah. you know, I'll tell you what, I don't normally pretend to be able to predict whether or not Andrew Main will like a thing, but I, for the life of me, can't figure, like, there's no editorializing. It's just everything raw as it was, and you feel like you're there. I think you're going to love it, man. I think it's worth it to see in the theater.
The trailer looks amazing, you know, and I heard, like, oh, watch this amazing foot. I'm like, I've seen all this, but I watched the trailer. I'm like, oh, that is good.
Yeah, you get to be there ostensibly as, and I'm sure it's not the exact same time that the astronauts were lifted, but you get to be there for the entire elevator ride going up, and you get the immensity of scale of the Saturn V rocket. It's just great. Soundtrack, double thumbs up on the soundtrack.
Wonderful.
Nice. I have a pick. I just finished playing this over the weekend, and it was a fun, like, little six hour game or so. It's called Hypno Space Outlaw. It's been a little bit of a thing I saw on Twitter. You play as a volunteer enforcer on Hypno Space, this online internet like service that people access when they go to sleep. So you go to sleep and you put this headband on and you get to go into Hypnospace, which is this very, it takes place at the end of 1999. And so it's all like, you know, super compressed GIFs. You can get a virtual pet, you get stickers and wallpapers, and you're going around taking these cases of like, hey, you know, we found that there are people, you know, posting, infringing content of this cartoon character. Go and find it out, and we'll pay you Hypnocoin to you know, be this enforcer. And then there's a larger mystery kind of afoot, but this thing is really cool, and it leans really heavily onto, like, you know, the 90s web GeoCities aesthetic. They have like their own engine for building these web pages.
I was about to say, like, just technologically, I don't know how they pulled that off. It looks so authentic.
Yeah, it's there's a whole, like, I think they've got a web page builder that will makes a lot of this stuff easier, and they just have a ton of GIFs and images. Almost every webpage has auto playing music, and so because they have their own audio engine also, so people can make music in the site. And it's a lot of fun to kind of both have that experience of like, oh yeah, I remember, you know, GeoCities and people kind of getting their first taste of the internet, but also I'm not going to spoil any of the game, but you get to kind of see a little bit of progression in that stuff as as there's this relationship between the people who use the service and the people who run the service, and how different different decisions on one side impact the other side and vice versa. It's a very cool thing, and it's like on sale because it just came out. So this is super worth your time. It's mostly a puzzle game also. I didn't really talk about the game much, but it's basically a puzzle game. So Hypnospace Outlaw.
Sweet.
Groovy.
Yeah.
Guess it's my turn. My pick is the Masters of Scale podcast by Reid Hoffman. I finished the book Blitzscaling, and it's been a very interesting book about like scaling business. Masters of Scale, he interviews different people. You've got interviews with Mark Zuckerberg, Ev Williams, the creator of Instagram, also the creator of Instagram, and other people talking about, you know, what they made, how they did it. A lot of really interesting stories come out, like in Instagram, like stuff I hadn't heard about how when, you know, they're working on the first version of it, and the creator, he shows his wife, and she's like, "This is great, but I'm not going to use it." And he's like, "Why?" She's like, "My photos don't look very good. I wish they looked like our friend Craig's." He's like, "Well, Craig uses filters." She's like, "Well, could you have filters?" He's like, sure, I guess, if you want that. You know, and it's just things like that. You know, Ev Williams talking about Twitter, and, you know, when he started Blogger, he didn't want to do comments because he really like, why do I want to have comments on my blog? And then he goes on to create Twitter, which is basically an entire ecosystem designed around comments. People commenting. Yeah. So just a very interesting listening to people like, you know, Zuckerberg talking about how when he and Dustin Moskovitz were coming out to LA, like, yeah, let's go check out California. Let's go check out the Bay Area. Let's check it out. Cause they're in the middle of Facebook. They've got hundreds of colleges on board, and they're like, yeah, we might want to start a company somewhat day out there. Not Facebook. The thing they were going to do after this thing faded, they were going to do some other company out there. And, you know, there's an interview with Peter Thiel where he and Reid Hoffman, who are, you know, known each other for years, good friends, very polar opposites, you know, in politics and stuff. But they were the first two people that invested in Facebook. And they talk about how Mark Zuckerberg went in there, and, you know, you've seen the movie version of what happened, which is not what happened. And Zuckerberg explains Facebook in a very few words, staring at the table. And then he's like, well, I've also got a file sharing application called Wirehawk, if you guys want to invest in that, you know. And it's like how he tried to pitch something else instead, because he's like, I don't know, Facebook, maybe, I don't know, whatever. And then turned out, fun story, Facebook came out to be kind of big.
And happily ever after.
Yep, no controversies.
And they never did anything wrong. The end.
Well, you know, you get some insight too, because you're listening to him talk about how when they're building it, they're like, we're building it, but he just assumed somebody else was, you know, the real people, the real company was working on a better version. You know, they were working on the real thing, and we'll just make this until that comes along. And then you wake up and you're like, oh, we built it.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a very kind of like, you know, he was going to be successful and do something, but how that came about is just a very interesting, you know, one day you're like, it's like kind of like the story, like Bill Clinton, his first day, you know, as president, steps into the Oval Office, and it's like, he's like, well, now what? They're like, you're the president, you decide. He's like, what? There's like no secret meetings. There's nothing. It's like, no, it's now you're in charge. And you're like, oh, this is what I asked for.
Yeah.
It's been weird.
Get on the boat.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.